childhood mental health problems, especially anxiety disorders, have become a lot more common in the last 10 to 15 years. While the reasons aren't entirely clear, one thing is certain: it can be a big challenge for parents and children. Finding a balance between protecting your kids from unhappiness and letting them work through their own fears is easier said than done, but an emerging school of therapy is helping parents acknowledge their kids' anxieties while giving them the tools to succeed in the long run. Kate Julian is a senior editor for The Atlantic. Her recent cover story is called "What Happened to American Childhood." Kate, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Kate, can you start us off with giving us a sense of a scope of the problem here, this big increase in anxiety and other problems among kids? What are we seeing?
So we started to look into this question of childhood mental health because there had been so many distressing and concerning numbers coming out over the past 10 years. The most eye-catching ones may involve the suicide rate for adolescents and for children. We know that as suicides among all Americans have increased this century, they've increased more sharply among younger ones. So from 10 to 24-year-olds, we've gone up by about 50%, a little more. And for kids like ages 5 to 11, the rate has more than doubled. We also know that depression has become much more common. I think something like 20% of teen girls now have an incidence of major depression in a year. We also know that anxiety diagnoses and symptoms of anxiety have gone up by about 17%. And when I started asking around, doing early reporting for this piece and asking experts sort of what should we be most concerned about and what can we do something about, anxiety was the one thing that they focused on sort of to a person. And that's because anxiety turns out to be a gateway to other mental health problems later on. It's also much more treatable than those other problems. So it's a really important target for prevention. Happily, we know a lot more about how it works.
Are we seeing that kind of increase in anxiety as well, alongside that increase in depression and suicide you talked about?
Yeah, so with all of these things, with the exception of suicide, of course, it can be a bit tricky to know how much is due to increased awareness and diagnosis and how much is an actual increase in prevalence. It does appear that actual anxiety disorders are increasing when we look at the percentage of kids who are experiencing various symptoms as reported to healthcare providers. Certainly, increased diagnosis and awareness is also, is also part of what's going on. But what's really fascinating here is that even without the increase, we now know from research that's been going on for the past few decades that anxiety disorders are much, much more common in childhood than we once realized they were. Sort of the increase notwithstanding, this is much more widespread than when we once thought that it was. And we know that because researchers have done these longitudinal long-term studies where they look at adults who have various problems ranging from depression to addiction. And when they go back and try to figure out when did their symptoms first start, most often the answer is in childhood with an anxiety disorder.
That's one of the things in your piece one of the many things in your piece, not only that surprised me, Kate, this idea that anxiety in an early age, anxiety in and of itself can be a big problem, but it's also like the kernel, the germ of later and related mental health concerns. Can you talk about how that starting point of anxiety at an early age can lead to so many different problems down the road?
Yeah. So the first thing I want to emphasize here is that having an anxiety disorder in childhood by no means dooms you to a lifetime of unhappiness, right? Most kids who have anxiety disorders are going to go on to be perfectly fine. But the reverse is not true. You know, most people who are not perfectly fine in adulthood, as I said, did start out with anxiety in childhood. We know that the average onset age for an anxiety disorder or symptoms thereof is 11. And for some anxiety disorders, such as separation anxiety, which is a common one in childhood, or phobia, it can start earlier, even, as early as 7 in some cases on average. And what tends to happen is that because we as parents misunderstand what anxiety is and what an anxiety disorder is, we respond to it in a way that doesn't set kids up to learn to deal with their problems in the long term. Let me back up really quickly and just say a bit more about that. So when we hear the word anxiety, we tend to think this is a problem, this is pathological. And the truth is, anxiety is a universal human emotion. So stress, worry are part of life. They're part of life for everybody. Everybody is going to encounter them at one point. What researchers have found is that when people don't learn to tolerate the feelings of stress and worry and the anxiety that they provoke, that then they begin to do anything and everything they can to avoid the things that cause them those feelings. And that's when you wind up with the situation where the anxiety is ongoing, it doesn't remit, it doesn't relax when circumstances do, and when it starts to really control your life.
We're talking to Kate Julian, senior editor at The Atlantic, talking about anxiety, kids, and parenting and possible solutions to anxiety problems at an early age. And Kate, you talked to a lot of people about this, and they pointed you toward one school of thought, one kind of treatment, often focusing on parents and how they react when they see those early instances of anxiety. What kind of things did you find out?
So we know that anxiety in general, so for kids and adults, is really responsive to cognitive behavioral therapy. This is the gold standard treatment for anxiety. It's the gold standard treatment for a number of mental health conditions, but it works even better for anxiety than it does for things like depression. The problem is it requires a lot of motivation on the part of the patient. So anxiety, if we say anxiety, sort of the hallmark of anxiety is avoiding things that stress you out, right? So the hallmark of CBT, experts like to say, is exposure to those things so that you learn to tolerate this discomfort, you learn to be resilient. But if you're a young kid, you may not always want to do that, right? Let's say you have intense separation anxiety, intense social anxiety. The last thing you may want to do is go and expose yourself to those things and do that hard work. So what's emerging now is another approach which uses some of the same principles of helping kids to learn to confront the things that trouble them. But by working with parents directly instead of kids, you can reach kids who may not be so motivated to get help. A particularly interesting example of this, which I discuss in the piece, is a program known as the SPACE program, which is out of Yale's Child Study Center, and it's led by a researcher named Ellie Leibowitz. And they have found that over a 12-week course of treatment where they meet with the parents once a week and help them to learn to do, to essentially back off a bit, stop bubble wrapping their kids, stop protecting their kids from the things that their kids worry about, that they have results which are really, really high, really, really effective, right? So something like 2/3 of kids have a very substantial reduction in their anxiety symptoms. And based on the research so far, the gains from this treatment seem to be really robust and lasting.
And some of the researchers you talked to made the point like, hey, we're not blaming parents. You're not bad parents here. But a parenting instinct or one reaction from parents, I'm a parent myself, I've been here, something bad is happening to your kid. It's making them unhappy. You want to protect them from that. Can you talk about that reaction and how it may in the long run be counterproductive?
Yes. So this is such an important point. I am a parent myself. Okay. I do not want anybody to leave this discussion or this article with the idea that parents caused some form of mental illness or are to blame for it. There's a long history in psychology of blaming parents for things. It's not an entirely good history. So we want to be really careful of this. That being said, this notion that underlies the treatment I was just discussing, the SPACE program, is really helpful. They refer, these researchers who focus on childhood anxiety and the role that parenting can play in it, like to refer to the things that parents do with the best of intentions to help protect their kids from unpleasant feelings as accommodation. And I like this word, and I think a lot of parents like this word, because the idea is that the parents are accommodating the kid's anxiety. The kid's anxiety is already there. It has some underlying cause other than the parent. And we can talk about how the parents can respond to it in ways that either make it a little bit better or a little bit worse. Interestingly, the research on this finds that almost all parents of anxious children engage in behavior that we would describe as accommodation, something like 95% of them do. But we also know that the more they do that, the worse the kids' outcomes are over the long term. So cutting back on this behavior can make a really big difference. The other thing to note about accommodation is that it's completely well-intentioned. I mean, this is, as parents, our job. We have evolved to try to prevent our kids from feeling distress. The problem is that we can kind of go overboard, and particularly, you know, in a context of contemporary parenting mores, and also concern about mental health, which can backfire, right? Like the more concerned we get about kids' stress and anxiety, the more we may paradoxically try to prevent them from that, when that's the thing that actually makes the problem worse. It's an interesting sort of vicious cycle that we find ourselves in.
We pick up our conversation with Kate Julian, senior editor at The Atlantic, about her piece looking at parenting at a time when childhood anxiety disorders have grown more common. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have anxiety or other mental health problems been a struggle for your kid? If you would like to share your story, what kind of things have you seen that can help? Do you have thoughts on why we see so much more anxiety among American kids these days, or questions? And if you work with kids as a teacher in daycare, as a healthcare provider, what are you seeing in your work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kate, I want to get into how some of these solutions work in practice. You gave an example of a family whose kid had a very significant food pickiness, doesn't really sum it up, turkey meatloaf like all the time, and how they accommodated, and then how they started to work through that after getting some help. Can you share that story with us?
Yeah, this is a really terrific example. There's a pair of parents who I call in the piece, Angela and Seth, who, when they contacted the SPACE program at Yale, had a five-year-old boy who for 3 years had eaten virtually nothing but Cheerios for breakfast and turkey loaf for lunch and dinner. The parents calculated that they had prepared this meal for him literally thousands of times. And they had gotten into this strange pattern with the very best of intentions. Their son, Owen, had had some feeding issues as a baby. He was premature and had some issues around that. And over time, they felt that it was their job to make sure that he was well nourished and to make sure that he was comfortable. And this led to this pattern where he didn't know how to deal with food that was unfamiliar, and it actually scared him. I mean, this kid was not just picky. He was actually terrified of unfamiliar foods. And with the help of the researchers at Yale, the parents were able to see that by accommodating this behavior, they weren't really helping Owen to get past it, and they were really hobbling him in the long term. The parents were incredibly down to earth and funny and self-effacing, but also very concerned about the situation. And so what the researchers helped them to do seems really straightforward, but it's actually, I think, not so easy for a family to figure out when they're in the midst of a situation like this. So they, you know, simply began to say that the family, first of all, should make some changes in the way they were approaching mealtime. This seems really basic, but like many families where there are two working parents, one parent had been picking Owen up at daycare, bringing him home, feeding him a dinner of his own, and then the parents had been eating after he went to bed. And they changed that pattern. They all began eating together, and they said, look, there'll be various foods on the table, and you can pick from among the foods that are on the table. But if you want to eat something, it's going to be one of the foods that are on the table. We're not going to cook you something separate. And when dinner time is done, dinner time is done. And it worked rather miraculously. Now, Owen is not ever going to be an omnivore. He is still what you would call a picky eater. But in day-to-day life, in most situations, he can find something that he is able to eat now. And this has these sort of fascinating ripple effects for the rest of his life. It makes it easier for Owen to go to school and to function well at school. It makes it easier for him to go to birthday parties. And in turn, the whole family is much happier. They can go out more easily and life is less stressful. And that has these sort of just wonderful continuing effects.
That points toward a common theme in American parenting. You point out in your piece on this that sometimes it's that making something work now versus the long-term plan. So, like, we only have so much time to have dinner as a family. Let's accommodate and not make it a battle. Or we want the kid to get sleep tonight. We want us to get sleep tonight. So tonight it's easier to accommodate the fear of the dark by letting the kid sleep in our room. This is a common theme behind a lot of these stories, right?
it came up again and again and again with families and clinicians in this one program that I've been talking about, but in a bunch of other cases as well. And it certainly rings true to me in terms of my own experiences as a parent and those of my friends. I think that when we're parenting in a very time-impoverished way, we just, as you say, we want to get through the day. And when we have limited time with our kids, we want that time to be as pleasant as possible. So our desire to have a knockdown, dragged-down fight about whether it's turkey loaf for dinner or not may be kind of limited. I think the patterns that people get into around bedtime can be very similar. The patterns people get into around that sort of frenzied, miserable time in the morning when everybody's trying to get out the door to work and to go to school can be similarly, you know, short-term gain, long-term pain. That's a reversal of a phrase that people who work with anxiety tend to use. They like to talk about how short-term pain, that is learning to confront your fears and deal with things that you really, really find stressful and unpleasant now, can make you much more healthy and resilient in the long term. Unfortunately, a lot of us are doing the reverse, right? We're privileging getting the kid to sleep tonight or getting everybody out the door over the kid learning how to do certain things for him or herself.
Talking to Kate Julian for The Atlantic, talking about anxiety and American kids. Let's bring on a caller now. John is with us in Madison. John, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering how cognitive behavioral therapy helped particularly in adults who might have grown up with anxiety. Personally, in stressful situations, it's hard for me to even recall what happened. I had to tell somebody to get a little bit out of my personal space or give me a little bit more personal space today, and I can't even remember exactly what I said to them. I almost have to script my response ahead of time, and then afterwards I don't know if I stuck to that script, kind of. Can you tell me more about how cognitive behavioral therapy might help somebody to stay a little bit more present when things get anxious?
John, thanks for that call. So for that adult who grew up with childhood anxiety, still dealing with it now, it sounds like, Kate.
Yeah, so I think cognitive behavioral therapy for anxiety is quite effective for adults and kids. There are a number of different tactics that therapists use with people with anxiety in the CBT toolkit. A lot of them involve sort of just identifying patterns of thinking that may be maladaptive and that may lead to stress or anxiety in the moment that's out of proportion with what the situation really warrants. Some of it can be, I'm not sure how each of these things apply to the situation that you experience today, but some of it can be sort of a matter simply of learning to kind of avoid black and white thinking or catastrophizing, trying to sort of come up with counterexamples that demonstrate that things are maybe not quite as bad as they seem or that the stakes are not as high as they may seem. In some cases with cognitive behavioral therapy, people will also, if they're very, very anxious about social interactions or about something going wrong, the therapist may work with them to actually do sort of exposure therapy, they call it, where they go and they sort of practice doing things that are embarrassing or awkward or difficult so that they can realize, that was unpleasant, but you know what? I made it through and the world didn't end. And the feelings of anxiety that were sort of peaking before this unpleasant interaction passed and I feel fine now. I could do that again.
John, thanks a lot for that call. Appreciate you sharing that with us. Kate, I want to spend our last couple minutes on talking to kids about difficult times and situations. You talk about that some in your piece. I'm guessing you started reporting this out before novel coronavirus was a household word. But based on what you heard from the experts, what are ways to, you know, talk to kids in safe ways, younger kids, about a situation like this?
Yeah, so it is interesting. This piece I wrote before the current pandemic, but the last section of it does talk about this question of how in our effort to prevent our kids' discomfort in much the same ways that I've been talking about throughout this conversation, we may avoid topics that we think are stressful or dark or tricky. There's an anecdote I share in the piece about some research done around the Loma Prieta earthquake in San Francisco in 1989 that looked at how kids who grappled with that tragedy, who lived in the area and grappled with that tragedy honestly did much better in the weeks and months that followed. And I think there's something to that in the current situation as well. I've had the privileged to speak in the past few weeks with a bunch of people who were involved in this piece, clinicians, researchers, experts again, and to ask them for their advice on how to talk to kids about COVID. And I think the short answer they said is, please, by all means, talk to them. There's an unfortunate phenomenon going on right now where a lot of parents are worried to be honest about the uncertainty and some of the more worrisome aspects of the current situation. But the sort of short and long and short of it is that kids are smart and they're observant. They can tell that things are not normal now. Even very young children can. So we should try to model for them as best we can our own calm in the face of uncertainty. And we should also be candid about the things that we don't know. Finally, and this may be emotionally the most difficult part for parents, kids tend, even in the best of circumstances outside of this context, to think about what would happen if, for example, their own parents were to die. This is a kind of universal childhood fear. We should talk to them about that. They've already gone there. Parents tend to worry about bringing up unpleasant or scary topics with kids because they think that they might be introducing the topic to the child. That's almost never the case, especially when it comes to this issue. So talk to your kid. You know, tell them what the plan would be if something like that happened.
Kate, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Kate Julian, senior editor at The Atlantic. She talked with us about her cover story for The Atlantic's May edition about youth anxiety and parenting, headlined, What Happened to American Childhood?